Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Friday, June 2nd. Today, our Friday featured story turns our focus to Colorado authors. And this week, Sun writer and Sun Lit editor Kevin Simpson chats with Colorado Book Award finalist Harrison Candelaria Fletcher. Before we start, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Pinnacle Assurance. Pinnacle Assurance is a workers' comp provider that's now offering enhanced coverage across the country. Pinnacle provides protection to Colorado businesses as they grow, no matter where that may be. Pinnacle goes where Colorado businesses go. Visit Pinnacle, that's PINNACOL.com for more information. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed a bill to establish a federal land office in Colorado Territory. This agency, working with surveyors, divided up much of the territory within Colorado into easily defined and distributed units to encourage American settlement. From the air, much of the United States looks like a checkerboard, a vast series of squares. Some squares have circles inside, thanks to Strasburg resident Frank Zybach and the center pivot irrigation sprinklers he patented in 1952. The geometric land division predates even the U.S. Constitution. In 1785, the Confederation government created during the American Revolution to bring the 13 states together adopted the Land Ordinance. It authorized a simple, practical way to define tracts west of the Appalachian Mountains, carving up land into squares. Its uniformity ignored regional conditions, treating swamps, deserts, forests, grasslands, and mountain peaks equally. For 7 decades, Coloradans bought or homesteaded over 22 million acres, or approximately a third of the state. The rest remained in federal hands for forests, parks, grazing, or military use, devolved to the state to sell for public education, or survived as American Indian reservations. Next, our feature story.
Happy Friday, Colorado. We're heading into Colorado Book Awards season, and that means you'll see many of the finalists for these prestigious honors in our Sunlit feature in the weeks and months ahead. And today, we're talking to the author of one of those finalists, Harrison Candelaria Fletcher, whose book, Finding Carencia, Essays from In Between, is a finalist in the creative nonfiction category. Welcome, Harrison.
Hi, welcome everybody. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you everybody at the Sun and Sunlit. You're great, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, there's a lot of talk these days about identity, and I think it's especially interesting that Finding Carencia has a really unique take on identity, not just the identities that are perhaps obvious to us, but ones that straddle lines or have feet in two worlds, so to speak. So what prompted you to tackle this subject?
Boy, that's a good question. This is something that's been percolating, you know, throughout my life. Just a quick bit of backstory. I'm the son of a Hispanic woman with New Mexican roots, like 6 generations deep, and a father from Iowa who I never knew. And I was raised entirely by my mother and her culture and her family in the North Valley of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that is the only identity that I've ever, that's the only family I ever knew, the only heritage I ever knew, the only culture I never knew or I ever knew. And but I walked through the world as a white man. I look like my father. I bear his name. And it's always been something that I've struggled with. To be seen is by others is not necessarily the way I see myself. And that's always been a difficult negotiation. And but as an essayist and a memoirist, you know, we're kind of drawn to those fault lines within ourselves, and we kind of peek inside and see if anything's there and explore it. And that's kind of what I finally did with this fault line, one of my many fault lines in my character, just went down into that chasm to see what was at the bottom.
Well, so this might be a good point to talk about the title and its meaning. What does Finding Carencia mean? And that word carencia is interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, the carencia itself is kind of a hybrid Spanish word. It has its roots in the verb querer, which means to want or to love. And carencia has been called untranslatable, but it's come to mean a place of identity and belonging, kind of that which we yearn for when we yearn for home. Carencia is also a state of being, or kind of the sense of peace that arises from when we reconcile who we are. And that's kind of what this book is about. I think Hemingway used cadencia in one of his books where you're describing a bullfight, and before the bull charges, it goes into the ring and it finds its cadencia before it comes out. So it's kind of a place where you derive your sense of who you are and your strengths.
So finding cadencia, then this is your search for that space.
Exactly. And it's a verb. It's not having found cadencia. It's a process. Yeah.
So you mentioned some previous interviews that it was a phone call with your daughter that was really kind of a trigger for you to begin addressing these questions, and that, you know, questions that you've obviously been dealing with throughout your life. When and how did you first become aware that you occupied that sort of in-between space? And tell us about that phone conversation.
I guess let me answer your first question first. Is like, when did I become aware of that space? Growing up in New Mexico is a very multicultural state. But I grew up in a part of the North Valley that was gentrifying. It's an old traditional Hispanic part of the Rio Grande Valley, and it was gentrifying. And every spring, the Latino kids, the Hispanic kids, would get into fights with the Anglo kids, and I was kind of caught between those two. You know, which side do I choose? How do I fit in? How do I negotiate? How do I stop from getting beaten up? So that's when I became aware of it. And when my daughter was a teenager, we lived in Richmond, Virginia for a while, and she had gone away on an art residency, and she and one of her roommates got to talking late into the night, and they asked her, what are you? And my daughter, my wife is Latina, and my daughter is 3/4 Latina, but she looks like me and she has my name. And she didn't know how to answer. And she started crying and she didn't know what to do. And in her, I saw those conflicts that I had had when I was her age. And so we got to talking, and it's like, and all those things that I had been wrestling with started to come to the surface as we talked. So it was just I didn't know that she was going through this, similar struggles as I was. And yeah, that kind of just opened the whole box of Pandora's, as they say.
So when you hung up the phone, did you immediately know that this was going to turn into a book, or was it a process here?
I'm one of those writers, and this is probably cliche, that you don't always get to choose what you write about. It's, almost the case that you kind of find your way to what you're given to write about. And this is just one of those conflicts I had within me that it just opened when, after that conversation with my daughter, and as I started thinking about it, and it's just a very complicated, unresolved issue that I had and have, and it just started coming up in what I was working on.
So we're fortunate to be able to feature an excerpt from your book this Sunday in Sunlit, and you offered the first piece that you wrote that eventually became this collection. It's called Open Season, which you've kind of alluded to in previously here in our conversation. But tell us about the title and sort of the in-betweenness that describes so well.
That was actually the first thing that I wrote for this book, the first time I tried to access or start to explore this liminal space that I inhabit. And it's called Open Season because that's what would happen every spring. And it was it's a complicated situation in the North Valley where it was. It's class, it's ethnicity, it's race, it's all those things. But every spring, there'd be like gang fights. And the open season was kind of how it was with all the Anglo kids. And there was, in the school, the Anglo kids were a wealthy but small minority. And every spring, there would be a lot of fights. And sometimes I was the target, and sometimes I, stood with my friends. And it was always I thought that I had to choose, and I kind of did. And so that's what that essay is trying to get at, is that uncomfortable space where I grew up the way I grew up, my mom's family, who she is. But then when I walk into the school, I'm just, one of the others. So that's what it was. It was trying to get at that tension.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the writing style you use in these essays, including Open Season. It's different from traditional prose or even poetry. How would you describe it, and why did you feel like this particular style was well suited for the subjects you address?
Good question. Thank you, Kevin. Well, there's two writing approaches that I tried with this book. And the first one was to write through a persona called Coyote, which is in New Mexico. That means like slang. It's slang for someone of mixed ethnicity or mixed breed or even mutt. You know, back then it was like, if you were a Coyote, you were kind of a mutt. So that's what they called me, you know, in middle school. And so in trying to, I couldn't write about this for some reason. I couldn't access this subject, you know, head on, like through the I persona. It just didn't feel right. But when, as soon as I, you know, put on that mask of Coyote and became that kid in middle school, then I was able to see that younger self through a distance, and I could see him trying to navigate his world. So the character in this book is Coyote. He's the young boy trying to figure his way, trying to find his way through the fault line. And the writing style is, I'm still trying to put my finger on it, but it's written in a way where the language is trying to find itself. It's the character in this book is very much a voice in search of himself. So the writing is, you know, almost like these root-like reaching sentences where he's just really trying to find his own voice, his own style, his own speaking. And so there's not a lot of punctuation because he's just a very fluid, searching character. And that's, I was hoping that the writing style would reflect that. And some of these are written, they're written in lyric essays, which is a hybrid form of poetry and essay. So it's someone who's trying to write his own vocabulary of mixedness, so to speak.
Had you ever tried this style before?
No, I didn't. I have a colleague. I teach at a MFA program, Vermont College of Fine Arts, and one of my colleagues, a brilliant poet, developed the style of essay called the Dervish Essay, which is kind of a spiraling, searching essay. And he would read these, and I was like, that is really interesting. And I just tried it. And then for this book, for this subject, it just felt that that was the only way I could get to where I was going. Yeah, like kind of a breathless searching for something that you didn't know that you knew.
Well, you talk in your Sunlit interview, the Q&A, about writing and rewriting the essays in these forms until they sounded right. And I'm curious, how did you know when you got it? I know you do have the advantage of having a very experienced and talented writer in your house, being married to Tina Griego, who Colorado readers recognize as one of the most respected journalists and storytellers around. But do you bounce your writing off her or others, or do you just kind of trust your own instincts to know when you've kind of hit that sweet spot?
All of the above. But no, it's you know, I'm extremely lucky to have Tina as my first reader. She's a beautiful, graceful writer who's also very direct when she tells me when things don't quite work. It's like I give it to Tina, you know, first test. But you know, for your question, how do you know that they sound right? I don't know that I always got quote unquote it, but I guess I would stop when I got to a place that surprised me. So with these essays, I started off not knowing where they were going to go. That's essay writing, I guess. But with every essay, with every section, I didn't know where it was going to go. I started off with an image or an impression or a feeling, and I just kind of went into that. And when I ended up being surprised is when I would stop.
I found myself wondering, too, after learning that your daughter had been kind of the inspiration for this exploration of identity, if you shared the book with her, if she's had thoughts or observations about it, or if, like a lot of kids, you know, they're not that concerned with what their parents do for a living.
It's probably a little bit of both. It's like, oh, geez, Dad, why are you writing about this? But no, she did. You know, we did talk at length about it, and she read all the essays in which she appears, but she's way smarter than me, and she's way farther advanced on these kinds of things. And I just talked to her recently, and she had a really graceful, beautiful way of describing it. And, you know, she's found, how did she say? She told me that being a white Latina lives peacefully within her. That's my daughter. She goes, yes, being a white Latina lives peacefully within me. Those two things can coexist happily. And she's already resolved what I'm still trying to figure out. So she's very Yeah, she's found an acceptance that I'm still kind of working on.
So you mentioned again in your Q&A for Sunlight that one thing that brings you satisfaction as a writer is when others see themselves in your writing. I wonder, have you had that experience yet with this book as it's come out and gained circulation?
Yeah, actually, I mean, that's kind of what we all hope, I guess, is that others can see themselves or their experience in our own. But yeah, with this book, I did recently, the book was reviewed by a young Indian American woman who wrote a really generous review of the book. And it really touched me because she's younger and she's a little bit old. You know, I think the same age as my daughter. And of course, I framed this review on my wall. But, you know, she said her opening was this book should be handed to every child of immigrants and every child of mixed descent in America. She said, I would have given anything for a guiding light like this. And I was like, that just really touched me that a younger person could see the struggle and identify with it and find some kind of inspiration or at least, you know, empathetic connection with it. So her letter meant a lot to me.
Oh, for sure. That's fantastic. Well, we've been talking with Harrison Candelaria Fletcher, author of the Colorado Book Award finalist, Finding Carencia, Essays from In Between. And check out his terrific excerpt. I mean, I think you'll really enjoy it, as well as a really illuminating interview in the upcoming edition of Sunlit. Thanks so much for joining us, Harrison.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kevin. And it's been great. And thank you, everybody at The Sun.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Reservoirs that serve water users across Colorado are in promising shape after a rainy May kept many from turning on their outdoor sprinkler systems. Natural watering played out along the Front Range and across to the Western Slope. This was the fourth wettest May on record and 11th rainiest month ever for Denver, and other areas saw similar rates. Steady melting of a healthy snowpack combined with those big rains are making water officials feel better than years past, but they remain leery that a quick change in the weather could rapidly affect conditions. Health insurer Friday Health Plans is dissolving, and that means 30,000 Coloradans will have to find new health coverage next year. The announcement comes after the Colorado-based company, which had operated in 7 states, ran into financial troubles in Texas that cascaded throughout the rest of the company. In a statement posted on its website, Friday said it has been unable to scale its financial infrastructure to match its quick growth. The insurer started in 2015 and has a large base in Alamosa after its 2017 acquisition of Colorado Choice Health Plans. President Biden is okay after taking a fall on stage during the Air Force Academy graduation in Colorado Springs. The president tripped on sandbags used to hold down a teleprompter. Nearly 1,000 cadets graduated Thursday, and in his commencement speech, the president warned they were heading into a challenging world faced with climate change, the war in Ukraine, tensions with China, and artificial intelligence. The president shook hands and saluted each of the graduates as they received their diplomas. This class is one of the most diverse, with the highest ever percentage of women and minorities. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Before we go, we encourage you to check out a new podcast from our friends at KUNC called The Colorado Dream. Here's a sneak peek.
The new season of The Colorado Dream explores the Black immigrant experience in Aurora. It's told through the eyes of one African woman.
I would sit on the beach and just daydream about coming to America.
And the city of Aurora that's working to become an inclusive home for all.
In the last 20 years, we have a new face of the city.
I'm Stephanie Daniel. Join me for the Colorado Dream Newcomers Welcome. You can find the series at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of the Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.